All right. For those of you that don't know me, which looking around the room is a good number of you, my name is Dan Stone. I am the headmaster at Dayspring Christian Academy here. I'm still getting used to saying that. For 17 years prior to this year, I served our original headmaster, Dr. Mike Myers, who, if you've been here in previous weeks, any first-timers in here? Several of you, but some of you have been here in previous weeks. So you know who Dr. Myers is then. He founded Dayspring, and he has been our headmaster since 1987. He is now in his current role as Vision Ambassador, and he's still on the board. And so he had asked me to come and speak tonight. My first job here at Dayspring was as a history teacher, and PA Civics was one of the courses that I taught. So I taught that course for about 7 or 8 years, and that was about 12 years ago. So I really enjoyed getting back into my old notes and researching and reviewing and even learning some new things about our great Commonwealth. And so tonight, my goals are to kind of remind you, or maybe teach you if you never learned this, about who William Penn was and why he's such an amazing figure for us to study and be inspired by. We're going to talk a little bit about our state constitution, which I bet a lot of people don't know much about. And yeah, there's a lot of really great stuff there. And then my hope is that I will be able to set the stage for local government, which is the final week. That's 2 weeks from now. And Dave Stoltzfus will be talking about our local government, what elections are coming up, how you can learn more about local government. There's something that I've been saying to people for a while now, and that is that if the COVID-19, whatever you want to call it, has taught us anything, it is that our lives are far more influenced by our local politicians than who is in the White House.
Yes.
Your day-to-day actions are far more determined and affected by who's right here in your own municipality or township or, you know, whatever you live in, and then moving out to your county and our Commonwealth. And we've seen that firsthand in a number of ways. So let's go ahead and get started. So this is William Penn, Pennsylvania, and our Pennsylvania Constitution. Let's do a quick review of our presuppositions. So these are some things that Dr. Myers taught in the previous weeks. So first of all, we are coming from the platform that God is sovereign over all of his creation. We also are coming from the vantage point that the natural state of mankind is that of individual liberty. And so that comes from John Locke. He is one of the philosophers that was widely read by the founding generation. And I'm going to paraphrase him, but he says that all men are born in a natural state of liberty, and they are at liberty to govern themselves as they see fit. And Locke would go on to write what some have called the compact theory of government, and that is that a group of people are at liberty to govern themselves, and they come together to form a government, to live together in harmony, and everybody lays down a little bit of what they would prefer to do so that they can live together in peace and harmony. But the natural state of mankind is that of individual liberty. Number three, as a result of the fall of Adam and Eve, civil government was established to protect man from man. So I know that Dr. Myers talked about the different spheres of authority, right? We have the government. Well, we have the first one that was ordained by God, and that was the family. And then we have the second one, and that's the church. And then we have the third one, and that is the state. And they're each supposed to have their separate spheres, and they're each supposed to stay within their sphere. And of course, we've seen how state has become the biggest, and church and family have become more and more encroached upon in the recent decades. The next one, God sent a Redeemer who gave his church the authority to bring his kingdom, God's government, to bear on earth. The United States of America was established by reasoning from the biblical principles of Christianity. If we abandon God and his law, then we will lose our identity and our liberty. So those are a review of some of our presuppositions. And now I'm going to behave and not press this button a whole bunch of times because it's not advancing as quickly as I would like it. There we go. So I thought we'd start off with something fun. This is something that we do, if you can remember. Did any of you take a state history or state civics course when you were in grade school? Raise your hand if you took Pennsylvania state history. I grew up in Georgia. I lived all over the South. I've only lived in Pennsylvania for about half of my life. I've spent the first half in the South. Don't hold it against me, okay? But I learned a lot about Pennsylvania, so let's see what you know. For whom was Pennsylvania named? Don't just shout it out. This is school. You're students. No, write down your answer, or just keep it in your head, because I'm going to come back. I'm going to get all the questions up. You can think about it, and then we'll come back to them. See, I should have been a good teacher and given you the instructions before I put the questions up. All right, number two, what is Pennsylvania's nickname? What is Pennsylvania's nickname? Number three, it's a combination. What is Pennsylvania's state flower? What's our state bird? What's our state fish? And what is our state mammal? So, how well do you know our Commonwealth? And I think I just have two more. Number four, what are the four major rivers in Pennsylvania? So some geography, some Pennsylvania geography. And then number five, one more geography question. Name a mountain range in Pennsylvania. There are several you could name. All right. Number one, you can just shout it out if you want to. Who is our state, our Commonwealth named after? Which one? It's a trick question. Senior. William Penn Sr. is who it's named after. And we'll talk about that and when we talk about William Penn Jr. What's our state nickname? Number two. The Keystone State. Very good. Number three, what is Pennsylvania's state flower? Mountain laurel. The mountain laurel. What's our state bird? The ruffed grouse. Good. What is our state fish? It is a trout. It's the brook trout. Yep. And our state mammal? White-tailed deer. Good. Let me just tell you, as a boy who grew up in the South, when I moved here and I found out that Pennsylvania, like statewide, has the Monday after Thanksgiving as basically a state holiday because it's the first day of deer season, I thought I grew up in, like, you know, the South. You think of like rednecks and you know, hicks or whatever. No, country is country. It doesn't matter how far north you go. That's what I learned when I moved to Pennsylvania. So hunters are hunters, north or south. So they take it seriously. What are the four major rivers in Pennsylvania? Not the Conestoga. What? Allegheny? Susquehanna? Delaware? Monongahela? Which becomes the Allegheny and the Monongahela become the Ohio River in Pittsburgh. In Pittsburgh. Good. And then the mountain ranges. What are the mountain ranges in Pennsylvania? You could say Poconos, you could say Appalachians, you could say Alleghenies, any of those would be correct. Good. Or you could say Mount Zion and York. All right. I want to start off with some of William Penn quotes. William Penn is really one of my favorite historical characters. I've had to really train myself. As I said, I grew up in the South, not to call him William Penn, because I get made fun of by my wife and my children. It's William Penn. I have to say it very distinctly every time, or try to anyway. He said, men must be governed by God, or they will be ruled by tyrants. That's a great one. He said, right is right, even if everyone is against it, and wrong is wrong, even if everyone is for it. I don't think these are going to be in your notes because I threw them in at the last minute. Oh, are they there? Good. Some people were looking like they couldn't find them. They're just probably really small, right? This is a great one for our youth. This is the great one for the young people that we use here at school. Right is right, even if everyone is against it. Wrong is wrong, even if everyone is for it. The next one, no man is fit to command another that cannot command himself. So we have a phrase that we use here at Dayspring with our students called self-government. We teach our students that the more you govern yourselves, the less external government you need. Or at least that's supposed to be the way that it works. The external government is supposed to leave you alone if you're doing a good job governing yourself. No pain, no palm, no thorns, no throne. no gall, no glory, and no cross, no crown. No cross, no crown is probably one of William Penn's best known pieces of literature. He wrote it while he was in prison. He said, "Force may make hypocrites, but it can make no converts." That's an interesting one for the times that we live in. Force will make hypocrites, but it can make no converts. On government, some great quotes here. He said, "Governments like clocks go from the motions men give them. And as governments are made and moved by men, so by them are they ruined too. Wherefore, governments rather depend on men than men on governments." He said, "It is certain that the most natural and human government is that of consent, for that binds freely, when men hold their liberty by true obedience to rules of their own making." He also said, "No people can be truly happy, though under the greatest enjoyment of civil liberties, if abridged by the freedom of their conscience as to their religious profession and worship." So let's talk about William Penn. First of all, let's do a quick biography of William Penn. He is William Penn Jr. His father was an admiral in the Royal Navy, and he was a national hero of the 1600s. William Penn Jr. was raised in a very affluent home, and he was able to attend a number of different prestigious schools. He studied the origin of government. He studied the nature of liberty. He studied the rights of man. He was very well educated. And at a young age, Penn told his mother that he thought God was beside him and guiding him in his thoughts. So he was very spiritually attuned at a young age. William Penn had a spiritual conversion at age 12. He met a preacher named Thomas Lowe. I've got the old spelling and the new spelling in there for you, who led a small group called the Society of Friends, and they're also known as the Quakers. Just a review for you, if you forgot who the Quakers were, their founder was a man named George Fox, and he started it as the Society of Friends, but like many things that get a name, it's meant to be a name of derision, and it ends up becoming the name that sticks, kind of like Christian. Christian was a name that was a term of derision at first. They were calling these disciples of Jesus, "you little Christs," as though that was an insult, and they wore it proudly. But Quakers is similar. Fox said to a magistrate, "You will all quake before God." And then they were all also made fun of because of the way that they physically shook when they felt the presence of the Lord. And so people made fun of them for that. So let's talk about some Quaker beliefs. And the reason I think this is important is because it's the Quakers. You probably don't see a lot about them today, and especially if you get outside of Pennsylvania, you don't see much about Quakers. But I think that some of their core beliefs are really vital to what we're dealing with right now in our country and what this whole initiative is about, and that's primarily liberty of conscience. Okay, so let's look at what some of the things that they believed. They believed that there's a part of God in everyone. They called this the inner light. I think we could probably refer to it as the Holy Spirit and say that we're talking about the same thing that they were talking about back then. The idea that each of us has a bit of divinity in us in the sense that we're made in God's image. So God placed that in us, and so each of us has the ability to have that relationship with God. That was a key belief for them. And it was different than the mainstream belief at the time, which was that you go to church and you simply, your religion is what your church leader tells you to believe. And the church leaders were controlled by the state at the time. So that's a very distinctive belief for the Quakers at the time. There were no ministers or preachers. In meetings, as this little drawing depicts, everyone sat quietly until the inner light prompted someone to speak. Has anyone in here ever been to a Quaker service? Okay. Yeah. And they still, my understanding is that this is still the way a Quaker service will function today. They will sit in silence until somebody feels what we may say in a Pentecostal or a charismatic denomination, got a word from the Lord. And then they would stand and speak that word. And then people would be edified, people would be encouraged, people would be challenged. And that was a Quaker distinctive. They dressed in plain clothing to reflect that our focus should be on the inner person rather than on the outer man. They believed in not serving in the military because they believed that all killing is immoral. The only time that killing was ever condoned by God, according to Quaker beliefs, was as a punishment for murder or a punishment for treason. Otherwise, there should be no killing, and therefore there's no rightful place for a Quaker to join the military. They refused to pay taxes that would be used to fund a war. This reminds me of another American historical figure, Ralph Waldo Emerson. He actually spent some time in jail in the early 1800s because he refused to pay his taxes. And he refused to pay his taxes because he made a big public statement about this and talked about, if my taxes are being used to support the institution of slavery, I will not have anything to do with that. That's a violation of my conscience. And he served jail time as opposed to paying those taxes. So this is something that would have been true for the Quakers as well. They believed in equality of all. They would refer to somebody as thee or thou, to use holy language, because they wanted to have constant reminders that everyone is holy. Everyone has that inner light. Everyone has that bit of God in them. And so we want to continue to sanctify and have elevated speech. So you wouldn't say you would say thee or thou if you're talking to somebody else. They number the days of the week and the months. And I didn't really dig into this, but my guess, I could be wrong about this. The fact checkers can get me on that later. But my guess is that they didn't call the months by the name because of the pagan roots of the Gregorian calendar or the days of the week. So they would call it the first day of the week rather than saying Sunday. So today would be the fifth day of the 10th month, right? And today would be the second day of the week, third day of the week, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. So that's how Quakers would have referred to those things. So just some interesting things about the Quakers. So William Penn comes into contact with these Quakers, and he really has a conversion to this particular sect of Christianity. He was expelled from Oxford for not attending church, and he became a leader of the Quakers, and in so doing, William Penn would write several booklets about his beliefs. So he wrote, his first book was In the Sandy Foundation Shaken. Penn was accusing the Church of England for being corrupt, and he was imprisoned for this. So when he was told that you will die a prisoner unless you give up these beliefs, he gave one of his other famous quotes that prison then shall be my grave before I will budge a jot, for I owe my conscience to no mortal man. From prison, he also wrote his second major work. This is probably his most famous. It's called No Cross, No Crown. And a couple quotes here. He says, true religion does not call men out of the world, but enables them to live better in it and excites their endeavors to mend it. William Penn was jailed for preaching in the streets. He was accused of starting a riot, and when the jury found him not guilty, the jury was jailed by the judge. So I want to pause here for a second, and I do want to be careful, I say with a smirk on my face, because I am an individual, but I am also the headmaster of this school. But as I was reviewing my notes and doing some new research and really just thinking about this topic, I couldn't help but notice a lot of parallels between what Penn was dealing with in the 1660s, 1670s, and what we're dealing with today. When I saw this, it really jumped out at me. So William Penn was brought before the judge, and he was accused of, he was preaching in the streets, but the accusation was that he was starting a riot. So that may sound familiar, that somebody who was doing one thing was accused of doing something different. And then the actual story where Penn is on trial, and he was a lawyer. He was when he was expelled from Oxford, his father, it's a great story of William Penn's relationship with his father. You want to talk about some family dysfunction issues, okay? William Penn was a senior, was a sailor. He was an admiral in the Navy. He he physically beat his son because of his displeasure with his Quaker beliefs. He shipped him off when he was expelled from Oxford. He shipped William Penn off to France, where he studied in France and one of the other mainland European countries. It's slipped my mind. He spent some time in Ireland. His dad kept, like, almost like modern day, send him off to a reformatory school kind of a thing. But he was educated. He was a lawyer. And so he is able to represent himself. And he's challenging the judge and basically winning his case. And this jury, so England at the time had a system where you could set up, or you had the right to a trial by a jury of your peers, especially if you were of the upper class, as William Penn Jr. was. But the jury was often instructed by the judge on how they were to rule on a verdict. And it really, I think, parallels a lot of, to me, I think that the bureaucratic system that we have today that is told by the elected officials what they can and can't say is very analogous, I think, to this corrupt system in England in the 1600s. So William Penn actually convinces these jurors to find him not guilty. And when the judge cannot bully and threaten and pressure the jurors into delivering a guilty verdict, he has all the jurors thrown in jail. So, I found that to be an interesting story as I was reviewing. Fast forward a little bit, and William Penn and his father do heal their relationship. It's a really great story. His father ends up respecting him as a young man for his courageous stand and for his following of his conscience. William Penn Sr. died, and he had left his son in his will. There was a threat at one point that he would write his son out of his will if he didn't reform his ways. So William Penn Jr. had approached King Charles II. I'm going to go back. Let me go back a little bit and just review the whole situation of the state and the church, for those of you that don't know. So in England specifically, I'll try to give you the Reader's Digest version. We history teachers think all the facts are important, and I'll keep telling myself that not all of the facts are important. Reader's Digest version is good. So the Catholic Church was the ruling authority of the land up until the 1500s. Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the door of the church at Wittenberg, started the Protestant Reformation. In England, William Tyndale had begun translating the Bible into English and under the rule of Henry VIII. Henry VIII imprisoned and then eventually executed William Tyndale for this treasonous act. It was treason to commit a religious crime because of the state and the church that were mixed. When it served Henry VIII's purposes, he wanted to break England away from the Catholic Church and make it into the Church of England. So Henry VIII wanted to divorce his wife. The Pope wouldn't give him a divorce, and so he simply broke England away from the Catholic Church. Divorced, that was his first wife. He would have five more, if that tells you anything about him. And then he would promote the translation of the Bible into English, and that was the proverbial toothpaste out of the tube, if you will. Once people got the Bible in their own language, the world changed. The world changed. There's a great book called The 5,000-Year Leap. If you want to look at like a meta-narrative of history, you look at the 4,000 to 6,000 years of BC and the 1,500 years up to the Reformation of human history, and you see the lack of progress in the standard of living. And then you look at the Protestant Reformation to today, it's astounding. And specifically, if you look at 1787, the U.S. Constitution, to today, it's incredibly astounding. And then even more specifically, if you look at the post-Civil War in America, when we got rid of that national sin of slavery, post-Civil War to modern day, the leap forward in the quality of living and the way of life is really astounding. But back to Henry VIII and the Reformation. So England kind of seesaws back and forth over the next 100 years between having a king or a queen who would make England Catholic or Protestant. But here's the crux of it for William Penn and people like him. Even when England was Protestant, it was still controlled by the state. It was a rule from the top down. So it went from having the Catholic Church where the Pope ruled, and the Pope told the cardinals and the bishops and the priests, the orders came from the top down of what the Bible said and how people were to live their lives. The Protestant Reformation in England, it simply replaced that hierarchical structure with a different hierarchical structure. The king was at the top. He was the head of the Church of England, and he delivered to the archbishops and the bishops and the priests all the way down. It was rule from the top down. So when you get into William Penn's day, there is a tight control of the state over religious beliefs. And so that's one of that's an important part to understand when we're dealing with William Penn and the Quakers and their breaking of the law. They're breaking man's law to obey God's law. And that's going to come up when we talk about what William Penn establishes as his form of government. So, fast forward now, Penn Jr. approached King Charles II with a proposal. The king could repay a debt that he owed to the Penn family, and more importantly, he could get rid of a troublesome sect of Christians at the same time. So Penn was approaching the king and saying there's a win-win here, okay? An arrangement was made, and Penn Jr. was made the proprietor of a colony in the New World. Penn wanted to call it Sylvania, which simply means the woods, but King Charles II insisted on Pennsylvania, and Penn Jr. said, no, that's too vain. We don't draw attention to ourselves as Quakers, and the king said, fine, let's name it after your father. True story. So Pennsylvania was named after William Penn Sr. William Penn Jr. agreed to honor his father with that title. So he advertised this colony as a holy experiment. And this was a new one for me. I never knew this, but this was really cool. I have a picture of a grid up there, and that's Philadelphia. So William Penn Jr., he was planning this city. And if you know anything about Philadelphia, if you can kind of figure out from the map up there, the laser pointer it deflects off. But if you look at the map on the top, you can kind of see the dark colored in area. That's like the original inner city Philadelphia that William Penn had drawn up. He wanted it to be between the Delaware River and the Schuylkill River. Schuylkill? Is that the way? I still can't get that one right. Like I said, I'm not from here originally. But after 18 years, I should know. Anyway, so he wanted to plan this out, and he laid this city out on a grid. And one of the things that he intentionally wanted to not have was any alleyways. He wanted wide streets with no alleyways to prevent crime. Because back in London, most of the crime, the pickpocketing, the violence, the prostitution, those were all happening in small, hidden away, tucked away alleys in the streets of London. And so he wanted to have a city that wouldn't be as easy for people to misbehave. It would just be laid out in such a way that things were done out in the open. That was a really cool new fact to learn. So he called it the City of Brotherly Love after the Church of Philadelphia, which is in the Bible. If you read Revelation, that's one of the seven churches that Paul is writing to, and wanted to name Philadelphia the City of Brotherly Love. That's a joke for people who aren't really from here. But if you ever go to an Eagles game, you'll know what that means. So. Another really cool thing, I didn't get this, but I want to read the quote that William Penn, you'll recognize this quote, it's a very famous line. When Penn was advertising for his new, for people to be able to come to Pennsylvania, he said, there may be room there for such a holy experiment, for the nations want a precedent, and my God will make it the seed of a nation, that an example may be set up to the nations, that we may do the thing that is truly wise and just. So if you can kind of picture a travel brochure, not really, but 17th century, William Penn, he actually does put literature together and advertise in mainland Europe for Pennsylvania to be a colony that would be a religious holy experiment. Okay? And he said that anybody, this is in the slide later, but I'll read it here from my notes. All persons living in this province who confess and acknowledge the one almighty and eternal God to be the creator, upholder, and ruler of the world, and who hold themselves obliged in conscience to live peaceably and justly in civil society, shall in practice and manners of faith and worship nor shall they be compelled at any time to frequent or maintain any religious worship place or ministry whatsoever. Layman's terms, if you confess to believing in the one true God, and if you agree to live peaceably in our society, you can come live in Pennsylvania. Doesn't matter which sect of Christianity you ascribe to, as long as you confess a belief in the God of the Bible and you agree to follow the laws, you can come live here. Unheard of for the 17th century. Unheard of for the place, for all the countries in Europe, Holland excepting, but the majority of the countries in Europe that had a state religion that you had to follow if you were going to live in that country and be in good standing, to be able to come to the new world, potentially to have an opportunity that none of those people, many of those people never would have had back in Europe, and that's to own property and profit economically, but to be able to practice their religion freely. And there was a really key phrase in there. He wasn't even going to require that you go to a church. You had to believe in God. But if you believe that reading the Bible in your own home on the first day of the week was what God wanted you to do, then you were free to do that. You didn't have to attend church somewhere. Unheard of for the time. So, really quickly here, just some of the groups that you may have heard of that came, that took William Penn up on his offer and helped start this Commonwealth. So, we had Welsh Quakers. They purchased 40,000 acres from Penn and hoped for an independent colony. And the English Quakers were too numerous to let that happen, but some of them did come. We have the Germans. Germans were the second largest group of settlers in Pennsylvania after the English. By the time of the American Revolution, one-third of Pennsylvania was German. They became known as the Pennsylvania Dutch. Many German Anabaptists came to Pennsylvania for religious freedom, including Mennonites, Moravians, Amish, and the German Baptist Brethren, who were also known as dunkers, because they fully dunked for baptism. All right, so a couple of the Anabaptist groups that you may have seen around here in Lancaster County, or maybe Southern York County, maybe even a little bit in Lebanon County. Jacob Amman was a leader within the Swiss Brethren movement, and he is the man for whom the Amish get their name. The Amish are characterized by simple living, plain dressing, and a reluctance to modernization. And then we have the Mennonites, very similar. Menno Simons lived in the Netherlands, and his followers would flee to the New World. The Swiss Brethren that did not agree with Amman would become the Mennonites. They hold to pacifism, they practice believer's baptism, and they wear plain clothes as well. I found this to be very interesting. This is a map. It's not great. If you saw it on a computer, you could see. This is, as of 2000, kind of a census of sorts as to Mennonites specifically, which parts of the country have a the highest percentage is still only 10 to, what does it say up there? 10 to 20%. But I thought it was interesting. Lancaster and Lebanon counties are up there as being of the higher percentage of our population that is Mennonite. But they've really spread throughout the whole country, even some in California. That's interesting. All right, German Baptist Brethren, we have the Dunkers. As I said, they fully immersed in baptism. And then we had the Ephrata Cloisters. I'll let you read about that. That's in the notes. But anyone ever been to the Ephrata Cloister to visit and learn about the cloisters? Okay, good. Everybody gets, all of our students go there in like second grade and get the jokes about you don't want to have a pillow fight with the cloisters. So, yeah. Okay. Another really remarkable thing about William Penn was his treatment of the Native Americans. So we have this in the Pilgrim story up in Massachusetts in the 1620s. If you fast forward to the 1680s, and we have a very similar similar story here with William Penn. Penn learned the Lenape language, and he sought them out to make a peace treaty with them. Philadelphia was the only, I believe, the only major urban center in America in the colonial times that did not have to build a fort to protect itself. You think of Jamestown, you think of Williamsburg, you think of Plymouth, Massachusetts, you think of New York. Wall Street gets its name from the wall that they had built there at the time. Philadelphia never had to have a fort built around the city because of its out of fear of the Native Americans. Penn said in his petition to the king that he should, quote, should be able to colonize the province, which might enlarge the British Empire and promote the glory of God by the civilization and conversion of the Indian tribes. So he had an evangelistic, at least an in part, evangelistic motivation. He obtained all the land transactions by honest purchase from the natives. I'll let you read through that quote. It's there on your notes, but it's a really rich quote about William Penn and the chief Tamenend and their interaction with each other. And I think it's a really important thing to stop and note with when it comes to America's Christian heritage. We have two fine examples through the Pilgrims and through William Penn and the Quakers of the original intent was not to come and steal land from anybody. Like many of the stories in the Old Testament, when God did a great work amongst a certain generation, it was a subsequent generation that fell away. We have the same thing here in America. The Pilgrims had a peace treaty with the Native Americans that lasted 50 years. It was the children of the Pilgrims and the children of the Native Americans who could no longer hold that peace together. And it was the second generation of William Penn's children and the Delaware tribes that were not able to hold that peace together. If you study history from a modern day textbook, you will learn that it was actually the Pilgrims and the Quakers who stole the land, and it's simply not true. There's a lot more to it than that. And even in the subsequent generations that could not hold the peace, it was the same for America as it is for every other country that humans are sinful and peace breaks down when people act in sinful ways. It's not a unique thing to America. So I'll get off that soapbox. All right. Let's talk about the government that William Penn set up, and then we'll get to the government that we have today in Pennsylvania. So the original charters for the 1682 and 1684 governments have some really rich, rich stuff in there. William Penn said the divine right of government beyond exception, and that is for two ends. And Dr. Myers, I know, covered this with you as well. The two biblical purposes of government, first, to terrify evildoers, secondly, to cherish those that do well. Romans 13, 1 Peter 3, they say that government exists to punish evil and to promote good. Okay? William Penn identified that in his scholarly analysis as well. He said, let men be good and government cannot be bad. This is a long quote, but it's a good one. He said, I know some say, let us have good laws and no matter for the men that execute them, but let them consider that though good laws do well, good men do better. So he's saying, some people say, let us just have good laws and then that'll take care of it. But he says, no, it has to be good laws with good men. He goes on to say, for good laws may want good men and be abolished or evaded by ill men. It is true, good laws have some awe upon ill ministers, meaning good laws will put the fear of God in some bad people, but that is where they have not power to escape or to abolish them. And the people are generally wise and good. But a loose and depraved people, which is the question, love laws and administration like themselves. I'm gonna get a little bit onto a current event here because this really triggered a memory for me. Do you guys know what's going on in Australia right now? Has anybody been watching what's happening there? I was shocked to hear about they're allowed 1 hour of outdoor activity, and they're being told if they walk their dogs and they see their neighbors, they're being told to not speak to their neighbors. The shocking thing to me was that by polling, the majority of Australians approve of what their government is doing. There are some people protesting, but it's almost 80-20 by one poll. 80% of the people approve of the fascistic measures that their government is taking, and only 20% of the people are the ones that are out protesting. And he says, but a loose and depraved, and I'm not saying Australians are loose and depraved people, okay? But the part I'm focusing in on is they love laws and an administration like themselves. You know, some people will say, people just want to be free. Not always. Not all people want to be free. Some people want to have everything given to them and being taken care of. Some people want to have the government provide for them. They want to know that someone has got my back, someone's going to give me this, someone's going to provide this for me. I think if they're trained properly, all people long for freedom. But there's a big if there. So another thing about Australia is that that's different about Australia and America, they don't have a Bill of Rights. They don't have a Bill of Rights. They do have a constitution that has some semblances of republicanism and democracy in it, but they don't have a Bill of Rights. So there's nothing really there for the people to say, hey, you can't do that because it says so here. Okay, that's a really, I thought that was a very apt quote here about some people do want the government to take care of them. All right, religious rights in the first law passed in Pennsylvania. So the first law that was passed under Penn's authority, that I read this before. Basically, if you believe in God and you agree that you will abide by the laws of our society, you can live here. No one will molest you. That molest was a legal term for people harassing you. It doesn't mean what it always means today. To the end that looseness, he says, to the end that looseness, irreligion, and atheism may not creep in under the pretense of conscience, he said the first day of the week was set aside for people to read scripture at home or attend services. So this is an interesting, because he's all about freedom of conscience, but he wants to recognize that people can't just use freedom of conscience to go live a loose lifestyle. You can't just say, well, I just believe that I can, you know, whatever, and that's my conscience. No, he was smarter than that. He recognized that freedom of conscience, it does not just mean license to do whatever you want. And so you didn't have to go to church. William Bradford did this in the Plymouth Colony as well. If you weren't going to attend church, that was your choice, but you weren't going to go have a party on the first day of the week either. You were going to, the day was going to be a day of solemn solemnitude for the whole town, but no one was going to make you sit in the church and listen to a sermon. So, interesting. Historian Charles Bancroft said this about William Penn. He said, government derived neither its obligations nor its powers from man. God was to him, William Penn, the beginning and the end of government. He thought of government as part of a religion itself. Christians should keep the help and guide the vessel. It should say Christians should keep the helm and guide the vessel of the state. Keep the helm, not the help. Sorry about that. All right, the next amendment, the Charter of Privileges. People of Pennsylvania were concerned that once Penn was no longer in the picture, the next governor would have too much power. Well, similar to George Washington. Yeah, we like the guy that's in power now and we trust him, but what about the next person? We have to think in principle. We have to think about precedent. So they wanted to put revise the law to protect themselves from the next guy who might not be the man of character that William Penn Jr. was. So William Penn and the people there worked out a compromise. They negotiated a new frame of government that would restrict some of the governor's power, enacting the first bicameral, which means two chambers, legislature, so a Senate and a House, if you will, a House of Lords or a House of Commons in the United States. The liberty of conscience was granted to all, again, who believed in the one true God, the right of all free men who believed in Christ to stand for any public office. So in Pennsylvania, there was no land-owning requirements as there were in other colonies. You simply had to declare that you believed in God and you were eligible to run for office. That was different from Virginia and Massachusetts as examples. Every year, each colony would elect two men to serve in the General Assembly, which would meet at least once per year. Can you imagine if we had to make them get together once per year? Wouldn't it be great if they would only get together once per year? Do we need a full-time legislature? I'm not from here. Pennsylvania is one of the few states of the Union. I don't know if you know this. Pennsylvania is one of the few states in the Union that has a full-time legislature. I think there's some fat that could be trimmed, to use a corporate expression. Every year, each colony, oh, I already said that. Pennsylvania was the first of the 13 original states that would have a popularly elected representative legislature. This was considered a model for future declarations of rights and privileges. In fact, Thomas Jefferson would say about William Penn that he was the greatest lawgiver the world had ever seen. That's high praise coming from Thomas Jefferson. I have a note in there about slavery. I'll just let you read that. Quakers once again set the example of the right way. I skipped over one thing. Let me go back. The bubonic plague had one of its last major waves in the 1660s in London. And the way that they one of the ways that they handled this particular wave of the bubonic plague was that if there was a house where the plague was identified as one of those individuals, everyone who lived in that house was shut in. They were boarded into the home. A red cross was painted on the door. Nobody was allowed to come in or go out of that home for 40 days. So basically, if you or a family member got the bubonic plague, everybody was going to be in the house, and whoever survived, survived. Best of luck. Guess who broke the law to help people who were sick? The Quakers. So in the bubonic plague, in America, the abolition, the Underground Railroad, many of the people who had stations that would harbor fugitive slaves were Quakers. They were known as a great reputation to be known as a people whose religious belief calls us consistently, historically, to violate man's law when it goes against God's law. That God's law is the standard, and when man's law violates God's law, we will go with God every time, come what may. A lot of good to be said about the Quakers. All right, subsequent constitutions and our current constitution. The Charter of Privileges from 1701 lasted until 1776. The constitution that was written in 76 is in its fifth version. You can see the years that we have up there that it went through a revision, and our current constitution is from 1968. So, the Constitution of Pennsylvania, let's talk about that a little bit here. The preamble says, we the people of the... Let's read it together. We'll be like we're in school. We won't sing a song, though, because it's not the same as the one for our United States Constitution, so the song won't work. We the people of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, grateful to Almighty God for the blessings of civil liberty and religious freedom... civil and religious liberty, and humbly invoking his guidance, do ordain and establish this Constitution. So I thought it would be good to do a little comparison here of the Constitution of Pennsylvania and the Constitution of the United States. So I wish I could say that our state constitution was a simple document, because our United States Constitution is a fairly simple document. It's seven articles, really only four or five of which are like meaty and substantive and relevant for today. Our U.S. Constitution, the legislative branch, Article 1, is the longest article, and they get shorter as they go. So whenever I'm teaching the Constitution to my students, that's a great relief to them. Like, we spent a whole day just looking at Article 1, and there's six more to go. Don't worry, they're all shorter. And the seventh one is really short. It just says, when 9/13 of the states have ratified the Constitution, it becomes the law of the land. It's one sentence. They like that one. All right, legislative, executive, and judicial, and our federal constitution, full faith and credit, talks about currency and states not fighting against each other for trade and things like that. Article 5 is how we amend our constitution, which we have done 27 times. 10 of those were all within the first couple of years. Does anybody know what those first 10 amendments are called? The Bill of Rights. Good. Our state constitution is not as simple, okay? And it was written in the 20th century, so that probably is enough said about that. But Article 1 is the Declaration of Rights, and then just like our federal constitution, we have our legislative branch. We also have a separate article about how legislation is enacted. Then we have the executive, the judiciary, public officers, elections, taxation and finance, local government, and private corporations, and then amendments. And our constitution has been amended about 46 times since 1968. And if I read it correctly, it's not like the U.S. Constitution where we have the amendments that are at the end. When the PA Constitution is amended, they just write the amendment into the original statute and they designate it as a more current amendment. So. My favorite part of this was reading through the Declaration of Rights, and so I do want to read through a couple of these. I'm not going to read through all 28 of them, but this is just, I mean, when if people want to know why Americans think America is exceptional, it's stuff like this, if you ask me. And since I have the microphone, you did ask me. All men are born equally free and independent and have certain inherent and indefeasible rights, among which are those of enjoying and defending life, liberty, and of acquiring, possessing, and protecting property and reputation. Protecting property and reputation. Man, that's rich. And of pursuing their own happiness. Section 2, all power is inherent in the people, and all free governments are founded on their authority and instituted for their peace, safety, and happiness. If you sat in one of my history classes, you would hear that one of my pet peeves is when anybody refers to America as a democracy. We are not a democracy. Democracy simply means 50%, if 50% plus one of the people want to steal something that belongs to you, they can, because majority rules. We are not a democracy, and we never have been a democracy. We are a country of laws. A democracy is a country of people. It's a country of majority rule. Our founding fathers referred to democracy as mobocracy, and they were greatly fearful of it. You won't find the word democracy in the Constitution of the United States. It's a constitutional republic. It's a government of laws and protection of rights that men and women are supposed to use as a framework. What's that? I would love to call Governor Wolf. Yeah. I don't think he would take my call. All right. Section 3, all men have a natural and indefeasible right to worship Almighty God according to the dictates of their own consciences. No man can of right be compelled to attend, erect, or support any place of worship, or to maintain any ministry against his consent. No human authority can, in any case whatever, control or interfere with the rights of conscience, and no preference shall ever be given by law to any religious establishments or modes of worship. This makes us a wonder to the rest of the world, in case you didn't know that. When the rest of the world, when their government issues a mask mandate and they simply follow it, they look at Americans and they scratch their heads and they say, "What is wrong with you people?" And it's this. Our country was founded, and there still are enough people who take the position that there are certain rights that we have that come from God, not from the government. And I just use mask mandate as an example. There's lots of other things where other countries look at us and they say, "You guys are crazy." They don't understand, and that's the simple truth. They don't understand, and frankly, I'm okay with that. Section 5, election shall be free and equal, and no power, civil or military, shall at any time interfere to prevent the free exercise of the right of suffrage. Section 7, the free communication of thoughts and opinions is one of the invaluable rights of man, and every citizen may freely speak, write, and print on any subject, being responsible for the abuse of that liberty, freedom of the press, and the freedom to speak. I'm going to skip these because we're getting long on time. You can read through them on your own. They're there in your notes. They're very rich. I do like the last one. Section 27, the people have a right to clean air, pure water, and to the preservation of the natural, scenic, historic, and aesthetic values of the environment. Pennsylvania's public natural resources are the common property of all the people, including generations yet to come. A trustee of these resources and the Commonwealth shall conserve and maintain them for the benefit of all the people. Now, here's a really interesting example of interpretation. I didn't do an in-depth analysis of this, but I would bet that the original intent, which is something we really emphasize here at Dayspring, when we're talking about interpreting scripture, and when we're talking about interpreting primary source historical documents, what was the author's intent? That's very vital. I don't think the intent is that everyone has a right to clean air, pure water. I don't think that it's the intent of the authors of this amendment that the government is supposed to provide clean water for everybody. I think that the intent is simply to state that we value these things and we want to protect them for our future posterity. So, really quickly here, and then I'll be wrapping up soon, but I want to kind of go back to the framework of our Constitution. In case you didn't know, this is just a basic overview. Article 4 is the executive branch. The executive branch calls for a governor, a lieutenant governor, and a few other elected officials. But I looked this up just so that you would know what the executive branch consists of that's not in the Constitution. These have been enacted by the General Assembly over time, and that's not all bad. The governor's cabinet comprises of the directors of various Commonwealth agencies. So at the federal level, these are cabinet positions for the president. At the Commonwealth level, these are agencies. We have the Department of Community and Economic Development, Aging, Office of General Counsel, Department of Insurance, the Department of Corrections, Department of Transportation, State, General Services, conservation and natural resources, the Emergency Management Agency, health, banking and securities, Office of the Budget, Department of Environmental Protection, Pennsylvania State Police, Office of Inspector General, Department of Human Services, Department of Labor and Industry, Department of Agriculture, Department of Revenue, Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, Office of Administration, Department of Education, and the Department of Drug and Alcohol Programs. That's our executive branch. Moving on. Local government. The judicial branch first. The judicial branch. Pennsylvania is divided into 60 judicial districts. How many of you knew that? I didn't until I was doing some new research here. Most of which, except Philadelphia, have magisterial district judges who preside mainly over minor criminal offenses and small civil claims. Magisterial district judges also preside over preliminary hearings and all misdemeanor and felony criminal charges. We have appellate courts or appeals courts. The Superior Court hears all appeals from the Courts of Common Pleas, not designated to the Commonwealth Court or the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. And then we have a Supreme Court of Pennsylvania is the final appellate court. All judges in Pennsylvania are elected, and the Chief Justice is determined by seniority. In total, 439 judges preside over the Court of Common Pleas, nine judges preside over the Commonwealth Court, 15 judges preside over the Superior Court, and 7 justices preside over the Supreme Court. Elected judges run in 10-year terms, at which point they are required to run in a nonpartisan retention election if they wish to continue to serve. So hopefully Dave will talk a little bit about judges next week as he talks about local elections and how important those are. And nobody really pays, when I say nobody, most people don't really pay attention to the judge elections, do they? I can see where there may have been a good reason for that at a time where it was hard to get information, but you know, today we can find information pretty easily, so we should all really be paying attention to these local elections. Finally here, the local government. Local government in Pennsylvania consists of 5 types of local governments: county, township, borough, city, and school district. All of Pennsylvania is included in one of the state's 67 counties, and each county is then divided into one of the state's 2,562 municipalities. There are no independent cities or unincorporated territory within our Commonwealth. Local municipalities are either governed by statutes enacted by the legislature and administered through the Pennsylvania Code, or a home rule charter, or optional form of government adopted by the municipality with consent of the legislature. Municipalities may enact and enforce local ordinances. Pennsylvania enacted the Local Government Commission in 1935. So the commission provides assistance to members of the General Assembly on researching local issues. So that's a little bit of a breakdown of our local government. I think it's helpful to at least know that those 5, we have our county, our township, our borough, our city, and our school district. And not all areas have all 5 of those. If you, depending on where you live, you probably, hopefully know whether you live in a borough or a city or a township. Yeah. So. So I'm going to wrap up here, and then I do want to open it up for questions. Give me a second here to scan my notes. Yeah. As I reviewed and researched some of the parallels, some parallels really stood out to me. As I said, William Penn lived in a time where there was strict control over what was allowed and what was not allowed. You could, I kind of thought of 3 main categories that I think are analogous to today. Speech was regulated. You could not speak out against the king or against church leaders. And I just think there's a number of areas where we see that speech is regulated today. And the thing that frightens me, the thing that makes me really concerned as a citizen, it was one thing when speech was being regulated by private corporations, social media platforms. A headline or a news story that is only 2 days old now that really concerns me is that government is getting in on the act. people are going to school board meetings and making their voices heard, and the FBI is going to begin investigating school board meetings, and they're claiming that parents are harassing and threatening school board members. William Penn was put on trial, and he was accused of something that he didn't do. It was a little bit related, like he was preaching in the streets, they said he was causing a riot, and then the powers that be rigged the system to make sure that he was prosecuted. That's concerning. We're seeing pressure tactics, threats. We're seeing it in the medical field, the medical community. We're seeing how doctors and medical professionals are being pressured, threatened, fired. Parents are trying to speak up at school boards. Yeah, I'm reading through my notes here, but I already got to that one. So speech was being regulated back then. William Penn stood up. Are we going to have to stand in our day for free speech? And No Cross, No Crown, the book that he wrote, was all about how if we have to suffer for doing what's right, that's the Christian life. And we need to be prepared for that. Religious practices were regulated. You could read the Bible, but you could only apply or interpret it in the way that the government and the state church approved. And I thought of two hot topic examples that I hope, you don't know me, but my heart is a heart of love and it's not against anybody. But there are two really heartbreaking examples of religious practices in the public sector. One is gay marriage. When I was growing up in the 90s, it was all about we want equality. We just want equality. The early 2000s, it was legalized, and now there is a demand that not only is it equal, but we have to legitimize it. And companies, churches, schools, private businesses, there has been for a few years now this demand that you fill a quota of certain groups of people. It's identity politics. And I find that to be analogous to the religious. If you stepped outside of the religious teaching of the day, your speech was stifled and you were punished. And I think that there are some parallels to what we're going through now. I'm grateful that we have a Bill of Rights and that we have due process, but I think it is something for us to, our antenna should be going up right now. And the other one is gender identity. It has gone from don't discriminate against people to you must accept, legitimize, and incorporate them. And like I said, my heart breaks for people, but I'm seeing a country where I have to be careful who I take my children to when it comes to doctors, because they're going to ask my kid, are you depressed? Have you ever been depressed? And if my kid says yes, then they're going to try to get me to leave the room, which will never happen over my dead body, but they're going to try to get me to leave the room and talk to my child about mental health and try to, because we've lost our minds and we let 15-year-olds make decisions that statistically most of them will regret later on. Yeah. Activity was regulated. Church attendance back then, you had to go to church, you had to go to the Church of England, and we have seen the state try and lock churches down in recent history. And there are threats of monitoring activities. So I don't want to be an alarmist in the sense that the sky is falling and we all need to go into our bunkers and hide. And I don't want to be, I certainly don't want to say that we are at the point where we I think I'll stick with what William Penn said and say that thank God we still live in a country where people are free to follow their conscience. And those are some of the key takeaways. Pennsylvania was founded on liberty of conscience. Pennsylvania's latest iteration of the Constitution, 1968, thank God, still protects this foundational piece of our Commonwealth's history. So that's kind of an anticlimactic way to end, but that's my lesson on William Penn and the founding of our great Commonwealth. And so I hope that you are encouraged that if you are a person of conscience, you know, earth is not our home, ultimately. We're citizens of the kingdom if we know Christ as our Savior. And I hope each of you knows Christ as your Savior. And if you do, we're citizens of the kingdom. But he placed us in America in the 21st century, and he gave us a conscience, and he gave us his word. And, you know, we need to follow that. And thank God we still have the freedom to do so. But if the time comes where that freedom is taken away, God's law is higher. Thank you. Well, I'll take your questions now if you have any. Questions, comments? Lisa has the microphone, and for the sake of the people online, I will ask that if you have a question or a comment, that you be bold enough to say it into the microphone. It's coming around.
Yeah. Pennsylvania is a commonwealth. Mm-hmm. Is there any other commonwealth in the United States, and what's the difference between a commonwealth and a state?
I believe that Virginia, Massachusetts, and Kentucky are the other commonwealths, and I used to know the answer to that second question, but I don't anymore. Does somebody else? What's the difference between a commonwealth and a state, other than the organizational charter? It's primarily a name.
It's also each county is like an individual state.
Okay, each county has a bit of sovereignty then in a commonwealth, whereas in a state it might be different.
Oh.
Yeah.
What determined the commonwealth or state title?
I don't know the history of that. Okay. I think an example that comes to mind is that in Pennsylvania we have our school districts, and school districts have authority over their school district. I have family that lives in Virginia, and they go by whatever the county says. So all the schools in a county in a different state will maybe act a certain way, whereas in Pennsylvania, different school districts might do things a little bit differently. Okay. But I'm not totally sure on the answer to that question. That's one example I could think of, but.
No further questions.
Oh, thank you. Good, because I don't. You gave me all the hard ones that I wasn't prepared for. So, yeah, Laura.
What does it take to rewrite our Constitution, and why would it have been done five different times, and could it happen again?
Our Constitution can be amended by the state legislature, can propose amendments, and then it goes up for a vote. A second way is also the calling of a constitutional convention, and that takes a two-thirds majority to call a constitutional convention.
And that's what they did in 1968.
I believe that's what they did in 1968, okay. Yes. That's another topic that I think is really important. Whether we're talking about our commonwealth or we're talking about our country, most people don't realize that the founders put, you know, speaking of the whole difference between a democracy and a republic, the founders intended for there to be gridlock in the nation's capital. A lot of people are like, oh, this Congress can't do anything. Good! Look at what they're trying to do.
Yes.
I'm glad they can't do anything. First of all, our Senate was not supposed to be popularly elected by the people. The Senate was supposed to be chosen by the state legislatures because the legislative, the executive, and the judicial are supposed to check each other. But even within the legislative, the Senate and the House are supposed to check each other. That's why the House is elected every 2 years. And that's why all bills that have to do with money have to start in the House. That's in Pennsylvania and in our Congress. All bills that deal with revenue have to start in the House, because the idea was, if those guys do something that the people don't like, they only have to wait 2 years to get them out.
Yep.
And the Senate was supposed to be to be a senator, you had to have accomplished something. It was supposed to be an upper class of people that would provide a check against the democracy, the mobocracy, yep, of the House. The House was supposed to be a rowdier group representing the common man, and the Senate was supposed to be a little bit more of an elevated group. So the fact that right now our country is in great danger of some landmark legislation simply by getting 51 votes in the Senate and a simple majority in the House and then a president of the same party in the White House, that was what our founders wanted to avoid, because changes can now happen very quickly. Because whatever this current Congress does, if in the midterms, they can just undo it. So there's a lot of, you know, people talk about Washington, D.C. being gridlock. It was intended to actually only accomplish so much. It was to amend the Constitution was supposed to be incredibly difficult, but even to pass laws was supposed to have some level of difficulty there so that it wouldn't happen so frequently.
Yes.
A little bit of a tangent, sorry. Other questions or comments? Yes.
I just wonder, Dan, what are your sources of information? You talked about this today at school in our little meeting, yeah. But you did tonight too. You said about identity politics, and I wasn't familiar with the term. I'm familiar with the idea, but what are your best like current sources of information that you could recommend to us?
I prefer Wikipedia, CNN, legacy media, ABC, NBC. No. Yeah, right. I listen to a lot of podcasts. Do you want me to give you some specifics?
Yes.
I listen to Charlie Kirk. Have you heard of him? Mm-hmm. He's going to be in Lancaster. Did you guys know that? You should come. It's going to be a great event. I listen to Ben Shapiro. I read Hillsdale and take their courses, Hillsdale College. I get in Primus every quarter and read that. Let's see. I am a person who I do look at Fox News and I do look at CNN. I just like to see what the different, and Newsmax as well. And I kind of just to kind of scan what's going on and what the different spins are on it. But as far as like some of the more conservative views on these things, Hillsdale is a great source. The Federalist is a great source. And thank you, National Review. Yeah, others can chime in. You know, the Daily Wire network with Ben Shapiro, Charlie Kirk's not a part of them, but he's of the same ilk, if you will. Dinesh D'Souza, you know, I generally enjoy. As an educator, I'm careful what I recommend to my students because I personally feel like I have a duty as an educator to teach my students how to win debates without owning your opponent. I think the Bible calls us to be respectful. I think the Bible calls us to be winsome and not to be arrogant and prideful. And so some of these commentators, I enjoy listening to them personally and I'm entertained by them, but they do a bit of the shock jock routine and name calling. So as an educator, I try to be really strategic and specific that if I tell a student about, if I show them like I had my students read Ben Shapiro's book, How to Destroy America in 3 Easy Steps. It's a fantastic read, but I tell them, like, you know, if you go YouTube Ben Shapiro, you know, you're gonna find Ben Shapiro owns leftist or you know, and it's like, just ignore, that's just noise, that's just clickbait. Just look at the substance of what they're saying, and that. So I kind of try to, you know, steer them in that direction as a Christian educator. So, excuse me, I'm going to cough. Anything else? Well, thank you, folks. I appreciate your attention. It's been fun for me anyway. I'll let you go. Have a great night. I'll hang around if you have any other questions or anything else. Thanks.